I've been reading a lot about the Shravasti Abbey,
mm-hmm.
and my heartfelt rejoicing that the monastery has been successfully built.
Mm.
So it's obviously not easy to start a monastery from scratch. So I just want to know what keeps you motivated all these years.
Okay. So he's talking about Shravasti Abbey, which is the monastery that I'm starting in the U.S., which is maybe, you know, the first, or if not the first, the second monastery in the Tibetan tradition and in the entire country. And so he's asking what keeps me motivated doing that, because it isn't easy to do that. You're right, it isn't easy. Okay. What keeps me motivated was, you know, I was among the first generation of Westerners to ordain in the Tibetan tradition. And the Tibetans are refugees from their own country. So it's different ordaining in that tradition than if you ordain in the Chinese tradition, where you have people have their own country with their own temples, or ordaining in the Thai tradition where they have Thailand with Thai temples. In the Tibetans lost their country, so they're refugees. So it's a different situation. So as one of the first Westerners, you know, first generation Westerners to ordain, there were no temples or monasteries for us to go live in. There was no financial support, because our teachers were refugees, and in fact they expected us to raise money for their monasteries. Okay. We'd had visa difficulties because when I started there wasn't a place to study in the US, so we had to go to India. So then we always had problems with our visas in India and Nepal, and having to leave the country and go here and there. And then back in those days, you know, if you lived in India, you usually got sick a few times. Now situations have changed. So we had a lot of health problems, and we had language problems because, you know, hardly anything had been translated from Tibetan into English. So, you know, just through my own experience of what I went through in trying to learn, and especially not having a monastery where we could get trained, and not having the financial support, you know, where you're worried about, you know, how am I going to get enough money to eat? Then I felt like, you know, somebody has to do something for the future generations. And for a long time I just thought, well, you know, my teachers will do something. I mean, after all, my teachers have many more qualities. They should be teaching. They should start the monasteries because they have more resources. They have more qualities. But then I realized that my Tibetan teachers were not going to start monasteries in the West, because they have all their Tibetan students to take care of, who are, you know, not only in Tibet but also in India. And so I began to realize that, you know, we who aren't Tibetans but follow Tibetan tradition have to do something to help ourselves. We can't wait for other people to do it. So I just said, you know, somebody's got to do this. Might as well be me. And actually, another thing that gave me the motivation was, you know, Buddhism is very new in the West. And people, especially in America, because America is mostly a Protestant country, people don't know what monastics are, and they don't appreciate monastics. They think if you're a monk or a nun, it's because you're avoiding relationships, or you're trying to get a free lunch or something like that. Okay? They don't understand what you're doing, and they don't have the mind that wants to support you. You know, they say, why should I work hard and offer you dana so you can practice? If I work hard, I'm going to use the money so I can go practice. You know, why should I give it to you for you to practice? So, you know, there's a lot of challenges in bringing the monastic tradition into a culture that doesn't have the history of monastic life. And I feel it's extremely important that the monastic life survive. You know, although monastics are always a very small percentage of the Buddhist population, historically it's been the monastics who have preserved the teachings and preserved the practice lineages and who have, you know, reserved the Dharma from one generation to the next so that the teachings still exist in a pure form. And so I feel it's incredibly important to preserve that tradition and give people the option to become monastics. And so for all those reasons, I said, you know, somebody has to do something. So it might as well be me. So you jump in. And, you know, it's funny. I was talking to a friend of mine who is... She's kind of a Buddhist, but not quite. But she does a lot of social welfare work. And I met her recently. We were catching up, and I was telling her about how I just, in starting the Abbey, it was like standing on a cliff and just jumping off. You know, because you don't know if you're going to be successful. You buy this property, you don't know if you're going to have enough money to pay off the mortgage. You know, you don't know if anybody's going to come help you. You don't know anything, you know. It's like jumping off a cliff. And so I told her, you know, you just jump. You know, you pray to the Buddha and you jump. And then in the process of telling her that, I was thinking and I thought, you know what? That's not exactly true. Because there's no cliff to jump off at. And there's no bottom to hit. In our life, we are always in free flow, aren't we? You know, our life is always changing. We never stand on stable ground in samsara. You're always free falling. So, might as well just get used to it. And don't worry about crashing on the bottom, because there's no bottom to hit. So let go of that fear, because things are always changing. Whatever you do, they're going to change. You're never going to hit bottom. Okay? So I kind of rearranged my mind. So you just do it. And it's really been quite wonderful to see the kind of support that we've received, not only financial support, but, you know, people doing prayers for us, people coming and volunteering, you know, an incredible number of people come and volunteer. And what I also find very rewarding is the change in the minds of the people who come and volunteer. Because, you know, people, they'll work hard at their regular jobs, and their jobs are stressful, and they're tired. And then they'll come to the Abbey, and they'll work hard there. Because we were remodeling downstairs, so, you know, we have these big sheets of sheetrock. How many of you have ever lifted sheets of sheetrock? It's heavy, you know? And they're standing there, putting the sheetrock up on the ceiling, you know, and trying to get the drill in there, and, you know, and they're having a great time, you know. And right before I left, we had to insulate the underside of a cabin, and so four people were crawling in the dirt underneath the cabin. You know, because the cabin is up on four poles and there's just dirt, you know, underneath to insulate it, put insulation underneath the floor, and then, you know, and they're laughing, they're having such a great time. And so it's amazing to see people work very, very hard, but have a good time. And then they leave the Abbey and they feel really relaxed and they feel happy and they've made friends and they feel good about themselves. It's really quite magical. Yeah? And so when you see that kind of transformation in the minds of the people who volunteer, you know, then you see that the Abbey benefits not only the people who live there, but, you know, all the extended family, which includes Singapore, because we have a whole Friends of Srivasti Abbey organization here, people who work very hard to support the Abbey. Yeah. So it's just amazing to see the kind of change in the way people bring forth a joyous mind. It's really nice. And of course there are problems. Of course. What else is new? Samsara, there's problems. Yeah? Always problems. Okay. Other questions? So your question is about self-confidence and self-esteem, and how do we cultivate them without developing a very rigid sense of self and more self-grasping and more self-centeredness? Okay, very good question. His Holiness Dalai Lama talks about two senses of self. Okay? One sense of self is deluded, and it's what we need to abandon on the path. The other sense of self is something very useful, and it's something that's necessary on the path. Okay? So before I describe these two senses of self, let me, you know, mention that when the Buddha talked about selflessness, he didn't mean that there's no person and there's no self at all. He meant, he was talking about there's no inherently existent self. There's no permanent independent self or soul. But even the Buddha himself used the pronoun I. Yeah? Buddha talked about I did this or I did that. So, you know, Buddha had a sense of self. He used the pronoun I. Nothing wrong with that. It's the self-grasping and the self-centeredness that we're trying to diminish. Okay? So in those two senses of self, the deluded one is that one of self-grasping and self-centeredness, where we have reified or solidified the sense of self, and we've conceived and grasped at there being a real me, you know, a very strong feeling. There's really me, and I'm the most important one in the world, even if I'm too polite to say so to everybody else, that's what I think, okay? So that very concrete sense of self, that self that we are grasping at, when we have that very concrete sense of self, like when we're angry or when we're filled with attachment, that's the self that doesn't exist. And that's the kind of way of relating to the self through self-grasping or self-centeredness that is a deluded mind. Okay? That's the one we want to get rid of. However, when we have self-confidence or positive self-esteem, then the object, the self in that situation, is not that concrete, solid self. It's just the conventionally existent self, like when the Buddha said, I. You know, there's a self that exists. You can't find it. It only exists nominally. But when we have self-esteem, you know, or self-confidence, there's some feeling of, I can be an efficacious person in this world. You know, there's something I have to offer. I have the Buddha nature. I have some good qualities. There's things that I can do to practice and increase my ability to help. And I'm going to do it. Okay? So to have that kind of confidence, we don't need to be selfish. We don't need to be self-centered. We don't need to be grasping at a truly existent self. Okay? So His Holiness always emphasizes that bodhisattvas have great self-confidence. Yeah. Whereas with us, sometimes our lack of self-confidence is based on ego grasping and self-centeredness. Okay, because when we lack self-confidence, there's a very strong feeling of a solid I, isn't there? Oh, poor me. I'm so stupid. I don't know how to do this. I'm going to look like a jerk. Yeah, I'm going to do something wrong. I'm going to say the wrong thing. I don't know what I'm doing. Okay? That whole way that we relate to the self then is a very, very solid, concrete way. And so that lack of self-esteem, you know, actually becomes a defilement because it's misapprehending the self. And it's also making a bigger deal out of ourself than we really are. Like when we feel guilty, I'm so bad, I'm so terrible, I can't do anything right. That self at that time is, you know, superstar. I'm so bad because I can make everything go wrong. You know, I'm so important that I can make everything go wrong. That's self-inflation, isn't it? You know, sorry, we're not so important that we can ruin everything. So whenever you get into blaming yourself and feeling guilty and losing self-esteem, you know, remember, okay, part of this problem is my responsibility. But I'm not so important that the whole thing is my responsibility. Other questions? So the situation is that you're tutoring somebody who did very poorly, and the parent wants to push the child to do better and wants her to have more work and more punishment and, you know, do like that. And your feeling is that actually the child needs encouragement and needs to be, you know, some love and some gentleness and for somebody to see her good qualities. And I agree with you. Yeah, and then your question was, what do you do with this parent? I think you need to be frank with the parent, you know. And if it makes any difference, you know, you can say, well, there's been studies that show that people do much better when they are encouraged than they do when they're punished. Yeah, I mean, there's been tons of psychological studies about this. Now, that when people are encouraged, when they feel confident, when they feel supported, when they feel loved, they do much better. And so say to the parent, you know, that you think that they need a different strategy here in how to deal with the child. And say, you know, I understand your concerns about the child, and I also want her to do better in school, but right now we need to use a different strategy, one in which we encourage her and support her and give her love, because the one of punishing her is having a detrimental effect. Yeah? And so just, you know, explaining that to the parent. Yeah, because I look sometimes, and I mean, when kids are forced, especially when they're young, and they have so much pressure, you know, you're in primary one, and you didn't do well on your spelling test, your life is going to be a disaster. Oh, you know, give the kid a break. They're in primary one. And so what if you can't spell? You use a spell checker. You know? I mean, English is impossible to spell anyway. I can never remember, you know, how to do things. It has nothing to do, you know, with anything. And I think also, you know, you have to let parents know that their child will be a success not simply because they know a lot of information, but because they have a kind heart and they have good moral values. Because lots of people raise children who are very smart, but the kids don't have very good moral values, and then in society, the children have a lot of problems, and they create problems for other people. So you have to remind the parent that bringing a child up well isn't just a matter of cramming information into them. It's a matter of teaching them to have a good character and helping each, you know, each individual child has their own talent and nurturing that child's talent. You know? And the parents have to realize that, you know, they can't control what their child's talent is because kids come into this life with their own karma. And, you know, I've really seen this in dealing with some of the inmates, because some of the inmates that I work with, they are not very well educated. You know, they grew up in poor families, they didn't have a good education, but they are incredible artists. Absolutely amazing artists, some of these guys. You cannot believe. And they've never had one art lesson. No, they've just taught themselves. Stupendous artists. And so, you know, I was thinking, if their parents could have realized the talent that they had in art or in music or in sports or in whatever it is, and encourage the talent that the child has naturally, instead of criticizing the child and saying, oh, you know, you write your P's backwards because you're dyslexic. Well, so what? You know, the child has, you know, you can teach them how to write their P's in the correct way, you know, and you don't make your B's like D's and vice versa. You know, that's overcomeable. But each child has their own talent and their own individual beauty. And to really nurture that, so that the kid has some self-confidence. And then you teach the kid, you know, kids good ethical values. And that's going to serve them very, very well in life. You know, they won't be so lost. So sometimes in your tutoring, it looks like you have to tutor the parent, too. Yeah. And especially in some of the tutoring exercises, I think you have to make things really relevant. You know, if you're just trying to teach kids, like, you know, math, you know, 6 times 8 is, what is it? You know, you have to give examples so that children understand the relevance of something. You know? And some people learn by seeing, some people learn by hearing, and some people learn by doing. And so if you're tutoring children, you have to figure out that child, what way do they learn the best? Are they more visual? Or do they learn by hearing? Do they remember things that they hear? Or do they have to do it? Do they learn by actually kinesthetically doing it? Now, everybody's really different in their learning style, so you have to pick up on how your child learns and then help them cultivate that way. Yes? Okay. So if you have problems, can you write to Dear Abby? Sure. You're welcome to write to me. I can't always write long emails back. I can write very short emails back. But before you write, you might read some of my books and see if something in there answers your question.